All right, hi, this is Petey Pete, and I am back with you here on WGXC 90.7. I am so happy to have Sylvia Hassenkopf here with me. And Sylvia, if you could let the people know, I know you, but if you could let the people know a little bit about you, and then we could segue into what we are going to talk about.
Oh, no problem. Well, I am a historian, and the way I like to describe myself is a vernacular historian, meaning I love to get into the lives of people. And, you know, it's not just about the rich and famous. It's about the everyday person that fascinates me and why it is we do what we do, why we moved when we moved, how individual families actually survived back in the day. And my area of expertise is the Hudson River Valley, although I have done a lot of research in New England and New Jersey and Western New York as well, and certainly in Europe, which is where my family is from. I'm a first generation North American, born and raised in Canada, and moved to the United States 20 years ago.
Right, right. Okay, so we are going to talk about the origins of Christmas today, and I was wondering if you could fill us in on actually the history and the origins of Christmas.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, Christmas is an interesting topic because, you know, it's such a big part of everybody's, you know, year. You know, we all think about Christmas and the joy of having our families together. And for many people, it still is a very religious, you know, event, you know, the birth of Christ and so on. And last year, I wrote an article for the Greenville Pioneer about the meaning of Christmas because, you know, I grew up, you know, based upon the European tradition of Christmas Eve being really the main event where families get together and exchange gifts, have a Christmas dinner, go to church services, you know, that sort of thing. And then Christmas Day, you may still do a Christmas dinner, but it wasn't the same religious and cultural aspect as it is here in you know, the more English side of a Christmas. So for me, it was kind of an interesting journey to look back and say, how did Christmas really become founded? And first of all, I started thinking about, well, where did the word Christmas come from? You know, and it's really a shortened word from the Old English of Christemesse, and I'm probably pronouncing that terribly wrong, but it really means literally Christ's Mass.
Yes. Yep.
You know, and that the earliest recording of this phrase is really from a document in 1038, followed in 1131 by the use of the word Christus Messe. So that's where it started. It was like almost 1,000 years, you know, after the birth of Christ that the word Christmas came about. The word, not our traditions. Our traditions are really quite different than the earlier traditions of Christmas in England and in Europe. So Christ, the word Christ itself is derived from the Greek word Christos, which in itself is a translation of the Hebrew word Messiah, meaning anointed.
Anointed, okay.
Yeah, most people don't realize that. It's everything has kind of got a little path in history.
Right.
You know, you
got
to follow the word and the path to the past, and you usually are quite surprised. People celebrate Christians actually celebrate Christmas on Christmas Day, but Europe and my family, which are German from Germany and Austria, we celebrated on the 24th. But Christmas follows the date of December 25th, follows the Gregorian calendar of Christmas. Which is different than the Julian calendar, which was an old calendar that was originally established back by Julius Caesar. And unfortunately, there was, errors within the time, so that the dates actually started to drift.
Yep.
They didn't have the technological savvy at the time to be able to peg the, you know, time with the moon and the sun and the rotation of the seasons and so on. So you actually were drifting, and Christmas started to become January, February, March, and that sort of thing. So the Pope Gregory the 13th introduced a revised calendar in October of 1582. And with that, we came down with a set year of 365 1/4 days, which of course we can't do a quarter day, and that created the leap year every fourth year. But that established December 25th as Christmas, and it stayed very firm. However, many Protestant and Eastern Orthodox countries resisted that change, and it ended up with a tremendous amount of chaos in the world, you know, because all of a sudden you've got two groups of people, the people that follow the Julian calendar and the people that follow the Gregorian calendar, and all of a sudden commerce and international trade was getting really messed up. And so it took a little while until most people adopted the Gregorian calendar as really like the business calendar, which also affected our religious holidays.
Right.
Now, some Eastern Christian churches held on to January the 7th as Christmas Day.
And which why was that?
Because that was the Julian Christmas. That was December 25th was our Gregorian January. Yeah.
Okay.
So they're both December 25th, depending on which calendar you look at.
Okay.
So the Julian calendar, December 25th, is the Gregorian January the 7th.
I get
which
you
is now, I know my family would never take down a Christmas tree until January the 7th, and right. I never knew why.
Really?
Yeah, it's, you know, it has something to do with the 12 days of Christmas, which is how the Gregorian calendar married up with the Julian calendar, was the 12 days of Christmas.
I never knew that.
Yeah, so you got December 25th to January the 7th. And therefore you have both the Gregorian and the Julian Christmases joined.
There you go.
Yeah, okay. It was a kind of a cool thing to do.
Yes.
And then one of the things I started to think about as well was Christ really born on December 25th? We celebrate that day as his date of birth, but in reality, nobody knows when he was born.
Right.
Nobody knows. It's absolutely not written in any texts anywhere. They do talk, of course, in the Bible about the star over Nazareth, but nobody says that's December 25th in the Bible. I mean, there wasn't such a date.
I actually always thought it was a commercial thing that they made it that day because it was the day that they could celebrate in the winter. But it goes back to the Roman Emperor Constantine, correct?
Well, actually, you're actually
right.
But
I don't mean to jump you on that.
No, that's fine. You're actually really right because there's a number of reasons why December 25th was chosen. The first is that the Romans marked the winter solstice on December 25th.
Right.
Which was a date of great pagan celebration.
Which, in actuality, the winter solstice is technically on the 21st, isn't it?
No, the Romans actually did it on the 25th.
Oh, but I'm saying even today's
time. Today it's the 21st.
Yeah, that's what, okay.
Now, you got to remember, our calendars were different.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. No, yeah, okay.
But the second thing is that December 25th is exactly 9 months following Annunciation, which is considered to be the conception of Christ, which is celebrated in the Christian church. So, of course, you've got Annunciation, and the 9 months to the day is December 25th, which would make sense. That would be the date of his birth.
Easter too.
Although most children aren't necessarily born exactly 9 months after conception, but there's kind of like a wiggle room in there.
Wiggle room.
So then the third is that Romans did celebrate a lot of pagan festivals. One of their favorite ones was in December. It was called the Saturnalia. I'm probably pronouncing that completely wrong.
That's all right.
And it was a period of gift giving and merrymaking, and it ran from December 17th to December 23rd. So our penchant for, you know, using greenery such as wreaths, ivory, holly, mistletoe, the Christmas tree even, those green items, was really a tradition that was centered on the Roman New Year. So lights, that whole thing is very Roman in nature. And so when you were Christian, hierarchy back when we were trying to create Christianity as a major religion, the way to pull in people who were pagans was to pull in some of their traditions.
Right. And even with the Bible, I think so many traditions has been,
Well, a lot of, I think Easter's like that. Halloween is like that. There's a lot of different pagan traditions that are pulled into our current culture.
Yep.
And that's how you get people to become Christians, is that they're not giving up everything.
Yeah.
You know, they are accepting Christ, but they're not giving up all the things that they loved about their pagan religion.
Yeah.
And that's one of the third reasons why they thought December 25th was chosen as Christ's birthday.
Okay.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting thing.
Very much so.
Then there's other kinds of traditions that we have, like the Yule log or roasting a boar back in the day, you know, in the hearth, you know, were very Germanic traditions. We don't do that today. We've kind of moved on to the microwave and the
Swanson
oven.
Swanson turkey dinner.
But back in the day, if you're talking, you know, the Middle Ages and, you know, up to the invention of the modern oven, it was not unusual to have these big, large roasts that were going on, which are very Germanic traditions, actually.
Right.
And then if you really, and this is really going back, I thought this was really fascinating. When you think of the Virgin Mary, she's probably one of the most iconic symbols that we have of Christmas. And you have her sitting there holding the baby Jesus. I mean, you even have the Pietà by Michelangelo, where, yep, you know, she's holding the dying Christ. But that, people think that that really, that image, that symbolism really comes from the Egyptian goddess Isis, who is always traditionally holding Horus, her child, and feeding him. And they see that as being a symbol that the Christians hierarchy took and moved over to Christianity as a major symbol of Christianity in a way to bring in, you know, a large part of, you know, Egypt and that area who were still worshiping Horus and Isis as major figureheads in their own religions. And that way they could bring in, you know, Christians from Egypt. And we have the Coptic Christians that are still in Egypt.
Yeah.
And so that symbology I thought was really quite fascinating. Well, not everybody would agree with this, but a lot of scholars believe that this is really how it all came around. Another thing that we do is gift giving. I mean, this is really in 20th century, last 60 years, has become the center part of Western culture, is the gift giving at Christmas.
In some senses, it's overtaken the spirituality sense of it.
It has. In my opinion, I think I sit there and I look at, you know, children who have more toys than they know what to do with. I mean, to the point that some remain unopened, some are used once and then are thrown away or given away. It's become a culture of buying rather than a culture of, I don't know how to even say it. You know, it's just run away with commercialism.
Right. Well, and I guess in part and parcel with that, it's the you can go with the giving or the getting.
Right.
And I think gift giving and giving of not just gifts to gifts that you buy at a department store, but gifts that you can either make yourself or gifts that you can give to the needy,
right,
or gifts that you are giving something that is worth of value more than just something that's commercialism.
Oh, yeah, indeed. And I see on Facebook and other places where people have put out notices, I don't want anything for Christmas. I would like you to give to this charity instead. And I think that is the true spirit in many ways of what Christmas is about. It's not about giving. It's not about getting. It's about giving.
Right.
And I think that is just, to my mind, really a big part of what Christmas is all about.
Well, I think that's an important thing to bring in the conversation. I mean, this is what we're talking about, the origins of Christmas, and in a lot of senses, the origin has been lost in, like you say, from what I believe and what it sounds like some of the things that you believe too. And I think that's important to get out there, that, I mean, my family's starting to do that, and they've done that for a while now, that, you know, my parents, they say that they've got everything they want. If we want to give them anything, give to a charity and put it in their name, and that's even in that, you know, not just, and that is part of giving. You find something that is true and meaningful to you, and that's giving. And really putting something into it too, you know. So,
and I love getting things that are made, you know, where someone has taken the time to actually think about me and about, you know, things that are personal to me, you know.
Right.
So if they make a wreath or they paint something,
that's true.
I love that, because it's easy to buy a gift. It takes more time to make one.
Yeah, that's
true. But the whole tradition of gift giving really only started in the Middle Ages.
Right.
You know, we think this may have been going on forever, but it really just started in the Middle Ages. And it was generally at that time an exchange between people who had legal relationships, such as a landlord and their tenant. And it wasn't really gift giving between individuals to the degree that we do it today. But by the time the Reformation in Europe began, which is the 16th, 17th century, when Martin Luther nailed his, you know, theses on the door of the church, Protestants began to give gifts within the family. So, and they felt that the gifts were actually being given by the Christ child. So you have in the German-speaking areas a figure called the Christkindl.
Okay.
Who
as
is
in,
Christ child.
Right. Well, I was going to say that eventually turned into Santa Claus, Kris Kringle.
Well, that's a whole different story, the evolution of Santa Claus. Maybe we'll talk about him next year. But that's an interesting story. And he was actually, maybe we'll have time towards the end to talk about it.
Right, right.
But if we're talking about the Reformation, you know, Protestantism, a lot of Puritans loudly denounced Christmas as being the invention of the Catholic Church. Because during the Catholic Church, you have penances, you have to pay for penances.
Yeah, I know, right?
You know, so there was a monetary attachment to getting absolution in the Catholic Church.
I want to stop you for a second. I don't know if I missed it or not, but you were talking about landlord?
Yes.
What? I guess I missed that. What
well, landlords, just think about the song, Good King Wenceslas. The song is about a duke. He was later retroactively made a king, actually, but in reality he was a duke in Bohemia, and he went with his page to give alms to a poor man on the feast of Saint Stephen, which is December 26th.
Okay.
And so landlords traditionally would give alms or would give food or gifts to their tenants at Christmas.
Okay.
It was the bounty of the landlord to share, and it was part of the piety that went along with Christmas at that time.
Okay.
So it wasn't like everybody did it. I mean, we have Scrooge after all.
Yeah.
But this was the tradition, was that, you know, people in legal power would give gifts to their employees or to their tenants to share their wealth at that time.
Right.
And it was just part of the Christmas spirit, I guess, is one could say.
Okay.
So anyways, but when we came to North America, the Puritans came, they established their community. You would think they would share Christmas traditions, but oh no. Puritans actually loudly denounced Christmas, did not actually observe Christmas. In fact, in 1659, they forbade the observance of Christmas Day.
Really? The Puritans that landed here?
Yes,
really?
They did. They,
wow.
They actually put this notice in the local newspaper saying, and I'll quote here, public notice, the observation of Christmas having been deemed a sacrilege, the exchanging of gifts and greetings, dressing in fine clothing, feasting, and similar satanical practices are hereby forbidden,
so
in capital letters, with the offender liable to a fine of 5 shillings.
So that's good to know. So the people that landed here and founded the, well, however you want to look at it, that landed here,
yeah,
were all atheists.
No, they believed in Christ, but they were simple folk. They didn't believe in all this finery. They didn't believe in all this, you know, exchanging of monies through gift giving, and they felt this was a Catholic thing.
So, but they did believe in the Thanksgiving. I mean, they did believe in celebration of the Native Americans. At first, I thought that they celebrated the Native Americans and the Puritans were actually together in this. And then
that's a tradition we've created as well. We should talk about that at Thanksgiving next year, because that's an interesting story that is not the same as what we believe it today.
Well,
that's been something we've created as a very commercial kind of thing as well.
Really? Because I actually thought, and I've done research on this, I thought at the beginning we were thankful because they did, in so many senses, save us in the small community that we had here.
Yeah.
And then eventually things evolved into a mess,
yeah,
whatever.
I read recently that it was not quite the way we believe it to be.
Okay.
Now, I don't have all the details in front of me of that. But
I keep on, I'm sorry, I keep on getting you off track. Yes, I'm sorry, I have a tendency to do that. Go ahead.
That's okay. I mean, the thing is, you have to be careful. You don't want to say something that's not exactly true. And I don't have notes on that in front of me that would be more clear, let's say. But it's interesting. In England, however, the Anglican Church expanded the feast days So, you know, they thought, hey, this was great. We could have penitential seasons and we can add additional saints' days. And, you know, there was an opportunity for the church to actually make a little bit of money on that. So that became, you know, more expanded in England and less celebrated in Puritan England. In fact, even in Scotland, the Presbyterian Church discouraged the festivities of Christmas. The Parliament of Scotland officially abolished the observance of Christmas in 1640.
Really?
And it wasn't until 1958 that Scotland reintroduced Christmas as a Scottish public holiday. I mean, it's such a different tradition than what we're used to.
I know,
you know,
right?
It's just so fascinating.
And it's all
you
man-made.
Find out these little stories, right?
Okay, go ahead.
Now, when you think of North America, you have this initial, you know, Puritan feeling in New England. We did have a lot of German-speaking families that were emigrating. You know, we had the Palatines that were coming in 1709, 1710. There's a huge population of German settlers that were coming in. With them, they brought their Protestant traditions.
Right.
Now, the Reformation was one where caroling was really encouraged and singing in church was encouraged. Protestants loved to do that. Also, the tradition of the Christmas tree, which is not something that most other places had. This was really, truly a Protestant German tradition. If you were Catholic German, you did not do a Christmas tree back in, you know, the 1600s, 1700s, 1800s. You just didn't do it. This was a Protestant thing. And it was the greenery again, was the celebration of life and of Christmas and all that sort of thing. You also had Charles Dickens publishing in the mid, I think it was 1843, Scrooge, you know, the Christmas Carol.
Christmas Carol.
Which, you know, made people think about Christmas in a different way.
Right.
So, and then the third thing that really started to change things was when Queen Victoria married Prince Albert, who was her first cousin, but also was a Protestant German. And she loved him so much, and he brought his German traditions of Christmas with him, and one of them was the Christmas tree. So she adopted the Christmas tree in England as a symbol of Christmas and her love for her husband.
Right.
And that started off the whole vogue of Christmas trees in your home in England, which then migrated to America. And that's how we ended up with a Christmas tree in our homes.
Oh, well, I actually like the Christmas tree. I like decorating the Christmas tree. I like putting up the Christmas tree. It's just been a family history, sometimes having more than one Christmas tree. And but I'm pretty steady on not having the Christmas tree up a month after Warriors of Christmas. I'm pretty steady for
right.
After Christmas is over, you take the Christmas tree down. But now and then, even back in the day, we would do live Christmas trees more than
right.
The plastic fernery that we have now. And but yeah.
But, you know, you may think that we've been celebrating Christmas in America, you know, for quite a while. But in fact, it didn't become a federal holiday until June 26th, 1870.
Really?
Yes.
1870.
And then...
Technically, I was celebrating it illegally.
Well, 1870, not 1970.
That's why
you're
I was a little.
All right. Of course, when
I
you
need
start
more coffee.
Here, we've got now, you know, the Christmas tree. Carol started to be sung. you know, more popularly around 1843, that's when songs like The First Noel, Hark the Herald Angels Sing, God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen, all of a sudden were being sung more commercially.
I got to stop you there because I personally think the older classic Christmas songs are so awesome. They have so much heritage and so much quality to them.
They do.
I mean, we could do a whole radio show just on
Christmas carols.
Yeah, it's true.
And in fact, I just wrote a new article for the Greenville Pioneer coming out in this Friday's edition about the birth of Christmas carols and some of the stories behind the most popular traditional Christmas carols that we have out there.
Okay.
So that will be on the stands in Caro, in Caro, Greenville, Durham, Westerlo, Rensselaerville, and certainly via subscription at the Greenville Pioneer.
Com. I was just going to say, in the internet?
Yeah, she doesn't have it, Andrea, the publisher, doesn't have it a live edition. So you need to be a subscriber or pick up the paper to get the stories. And some of the ones that I'm talking about, just so you know, are ones like, let me see, O Little Town of Bethlehem. I talk about Away in a Manger, which has a very cool story. I talk about my German favorite ones, which is things like Stille Nacht, Heilige Nacht, which is O Silent Night, which is a German one. O Tannenbaum, which is one of the most iconic German ones, as well as English ones, which is O Christmas Tree. And then I also talk about, let me see, Good King Wenceslas. That has a very interesting story behind it, Joy to the World. So a lot of those stories, I talk about how that carol came to be and how we ended up singing about it. So, you know, it's kind of fun to, you know, discover the histories of those carols.
Yes, I totally agree.
And then, of course, the first commercial Christmas card was printed in 1843 in England.
Now, when we're talking about commercial, I think Coca-Cola had a lot to do with the history of commercialism with Christmas, too, don't you? Do you know any of the history of that?
I don't know the history of Coke, but I do remember as a child, old Santa Claus walking around with that Coke bottle in his hand,
that's
right?
That's what I was going to say. That's truly what kind of brought it into our culture in a lot of different respects.
Well, I don't know. I think it goes even further back than Coke, because Coke really, I think, started doing that in the 70s, and I'm thinking back to the 60s, where I remember Rudolph with Burl Ives, and, you know, some of those really old, you know, cartoons that we had as kids.
Well, yeah, I mean,
that looked funny to kids today, but to us were really quite amazing.
Well, the legend of Santa Claus goes back hundreds of years to St. Nicholas.
Right.
A monk, right?
I believe. Santa Nicholas. Yeah.
Santa Nicholas.
Yeah.
But Coca-Cola was the one that brought in, that you ask why... the colors of Christmas, why Santa Claus wears red. And believe it or not, present-day Santa Claus owes his red robe not to an ancient legend or to an early myth, but to Coca-Cola Company. A long time ago, Father Christmas was shown in clothes of different colors, green, purple, light blue, navy blue, brown, or red on the commercials.
Very true. And what's interesting, it was Thomas Nast. He was a German-born American caricaturist and political cartoonist who lived in the second half of the 19th century in New York City, who gave us the popular image of Santa Claus.
Mm-hmm.
Originally, he was actually quite thin.
Really?
But as time went on, Thomas Nast kept drawing him, and he kept getting fatter and more jovial and more rounder looking. So by 1870s, he was the Santa Claus we see today, you know, with the big white beard, big round belly. But when he was first drawn by Thomas Nast, he was much skinnier.
He was more bohemian?
Yeah, I don't know.
Most
Germans I know from Bohemia are pretty round.
Oh, really? Okay.
Lots of good beer.
Okay, yeah, right, true.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
And so, yeah, he was originally called Sankt Nikolaus, and in German it's called the Weihnachten. But we ended up calling him Santa Claus.
Santa Claus.
Which is, you know, kind of like a takeoff from the Sankt Nikolaus. So, you know, he has this whole twinkle in the eye and all that kind of thing. So it's kind of interesting to see him. So, yeah, Christmas has come to mean many things to many people these days. And our traditions all come from somewhere. And that's part of our history.
Right. Okay. Okay. So that was quite a... yes. Okay. So why don't we go with one more thing? You have some more information here or something that you want to discuss with the listening audience?
Sure. I thought I'd give you a little bit of a preview of our Christmas carol stories. Most Christmas carols we seem to think have been around forever, but in reality, the original Christmas-type songs were sung by monks in Latin. and they go back quite a long ways, all the way to the 4th century. So you'd have, you know, these Latin songs sung by monks, and, you know, the average person didn't know Latin in the 4th century. You know, they were already speaking various languages throughout Christendom. And it wasn't until, as I mentioned earlier, the Protestant Reformation of the 16th century that we have this explosion of songs that we call Christmas carols today.
Okay.
And Martin Luther himself, you know, the father of the Protestant Reformation, is credited with quite a number of Christmas carols himself in German, which many of them have been translated into English as well in the various Lutheran churches. But probably the most well-known traditional Christmas song is our proverbial Silent Night. Everybody, Silent Night.
Oh, okay. Oh, yes.
Everybody knows Silent Night. Everybody remembers Bing Crosby in his dulcet tones singing that on the record player at home. I remember that so clearly, you know.
I think one of the, if not the most famous song of all time, the most played song of all time is the song by Bing Crosby, but I think it's White Christmas.
No, it's actually Silent
Night. It is Silent
Night? It's the third best-selling single of all time.
Oh, is it the third?
It actually is.
Okay.
The more newer ones, you know, yeah, I remember White Christmas. I remember the movie, even. These are things you watched every year in my household growing up.
Right. And what was the big one?
Burl Ives song, wasn't there one?
No, I'm even referring to the Christmas movie. The one where he's going to jump off the bridge, but he decides not to.
Was that the Miracle on Something Street?
No. Okay, I'm sorry. I'll think of it, but go ahead with the conversation.
Yeah, no, that's okay.
I can't believe I can't remember it because when I go home for Christmas, every Christmas, my parents make me watch it.
I don't think I ever saw that movie.
With Jimmy Stewart.
I thought that was the Miracle on Whatchamacallit Street, but I don't think I ever saw that.
I'm going to look it up right now.
Okay,
go ahead
you
with
do
the
that.
Conversation.
So anyways, let's talk a little bit about Silent Night, which in German is called Stille Nacht, Heilige Nacht. It was composed by Franz Xaver Gruber with lyrics by Joseph Moore and was actually performed for the first time during Christmas Eve services in 1818 in the small town of Oberndorf by Salzburg in Austria, which is not actually very, very far away from where my mother was born and raised. It was also recognized by UNESCO in 2011 as an intangible cultural heritage song.
Okay.
Which is actually kind of cool. You know, it's one of those great songs that everybody knows and people sing it in English and I sing it in German. Actually, when my Hasenkopf family gets together on Christmas Eve, there's over 40 of us. And the longstanding tradition in my husband's family is that after, you know, having, you know, appetizers, we all go into, you know, the living room and everybody gets a sheet of Christmas songs. So it's like, I don't know, 25 Christmas songs, and we sing every single song in that book.
Wow.
Every single one. It sounds like a bunch of hens cackling most of the time.
but that sounds beautiful, though.
We actually really enjoy it. The guests who come just sit there kind of with their eyes like going, oh, my God, where am I? But even the youngest of our family join in the tradition of singing all these songs. But there are a couple that we sing in German, and those of us that sing in German sing them in German. And one of them is Stille Nacht, Heilige Nacht. So a very special song for our family. Another interesting German Christmas carol that I remember is, as I said, the O Tannenbaum song.
Yeah. O Tannenbaum.
I can't sing, so I'm not even going to try, and I'm probably the worst of the
chickens. I can't either, but I'm not ashamed to sing on public radio at all.
Now, what's interesting about that song is it had nothing to do with Christmas.
Okay.
It is actually an old, based
really?
Upon an... Yeah,
really?
It really doesn't.
Oh, way
it's,
to kill my heritage.
Yeah, it's based upon an old Silesian folk song.
Okay.
Called Ach Tannenbaum, which is about a faithless lover.
Wow.
Yeah, so when you read the lyrics of the first stanzas...
Okay.
It's about an evergreen tree whose needles remain green and true and faithful.
Right.
And that's what the song was really about. It was about, you know, someone who wasn't true and faithful to their love. And it was later on that a guy by the name of Ernst Anschütz, a Leipzig organist, teacher, and a composer, penned the additional stanzas in 1824,
okay.
which made it a Christmas song.
Oh.
So it's, I found that really fascinating,
it
you know,
is.
How
That's
you just take
cool.
a certain a piece of, you know, folk history and then massage it a little bit to create a Christmas standard that
Which
today,
is, yeah, classic.
Everybody thinks, oh, it's all about the Christmas tree. It had nothing to do about it.
Beating it, being a cheater. No, go ahead.
Well, it's something that faces all our human lives.
Yes, it's true. It's true.
Is, you know, faithfulness of love, you know.
Yes,
And then it became a very iconic Christmas song, you know, Oh Christmas Tree. And so another one that, a German one that I really love is something called O du Fröhliche, which in English is known as Oh You Joyful. It was written in, you know, late 1815, early 1816 by someone named Johannes Daniel Falk. And he was really a man of compassion. He had lost 4 of his 7 children to typhoid. And because of that, he actually founded a foundlings asylum, an orphan's asylum, in his hometown of Weimar in Germany. And he, while he was running that foundling asylum, he heard one of his foundlings, an Italian boy by the name of Pietro Gannucci, singing a Catholic hymn, O Sansissima. He took the melody of that hymn and then wrote O du Fröhliche, the actual poem,
okay,
to that, you know, Catholic hymn, and that became one of the most famous German Christmas songs, and of course in the Lutheran churches is still sung to this day, even around the world. So it's just a really, you know, I just think that's kind of neat that you have how you come up with these songs, you know. Well, it's, nobody really knows.
Well, I think that's even in music itself, that's why I've gotten into music so much, because music tells a story.
Yes.
Music can bring you to a certain place or make you actually feel as if they are talking to you because it's concerning something in your life, or it might even bring up a thought that you weren't thinking about.
Absolutely.
And there are a lot of traditions involved with that, which I think is really kind of cool and neat.
Oh, it is. And then we have, of course, many English Christmas songs, carols that have, grown up through the Episcopal Church, through the Anglican Church. And one of the ones that I thought was really an interesting one was how the Christmas carol, O Little Town of Bethlehem, came to be. And it was really inspired by a trip to Jerusalem in 1865 by Episcopal priest Philip Brooks, who was a rector of the Church of Holy Trinity in Philadelphia.
Okay.
And he wrote a poem about his experience. Well, as he stood there in Bethlehem, and, you know, just thought about the birth of Christ. And upon his return to Philadelphia, he went to his organist of his church, a guy by the name of Lewis Redner, and asked him to add the music to his poem. And he wanted it to be ready for Christmas services on December 24th of that year in 1868. So Redner later on wrote about how he actually came up with the music, and that whole story is in my article in the newspaper this week. And okay. It was just really cool. It was like it just came to him. He says he didn't know how, couldn't come up with the music, and just the night before, all of a sudden, he woke up and had the music in his head.
I totally believe in that too, that somehow there is a channel somewhere that is reached to you or you can reach, mm-hmm, that enables you to come up, that seems as though you can even write a song in a matter of minutes that is so true and dear to the heart. So yeah,
absolutely. The last one I'll talk about briefly is the song Away in a Manger. The lyrics for it first were published in the late 19th century, and it's sung throughout the, you know, speaking world. It's one of the most iconic Christmas carols out there.
That was written that long ago.
Yes, it was late 1880s, I believe.
Okay.
And some claim, however, that Martin Luther, the founder of the Protestant Reformation, was actually the author of that particular song. Others claim that it's wholly American.
Yeah, that's too. Okay.
It was found, the first time anybody had actually seen the lyrics in print anywhere, was found in an edition, the March 2nd, 1882 edition of the anti-Masonic journal, The Christian Sinister.
Okay.
Just said that right? I'm not sure.
I'm sure you did.
In a section called The Children's Corner. The anonymous author claimed that the following hymn was composed by Martin Luther for his children and is still sung by many German mothers to their little ones. The reality is that nobody can find anywhere this hymn in German, prior to 1882, certainly not in Martin Luther's hand. So most scholars today feel it is 100% American.
That's why I thought Tony Bennett wrote it.
Yeah.
But we'll stick with Martin Luther.
Well, we don't think it's Martin Luther. We okay. It's somebody, but we're not exactly sure who. But Christmas is a time of celebration of family and friends and, you know, a time of reflection, I think, of the meaning of what Christmas stands for.
It's
and
true.
I think that's what's important, regardless of what religion you really belong to, if any, is that Christmas means something in terms of people's responsibility to each other and kindness and joy. And I think that's, for me, what Christmas means the most.
That was so elegant. Very well put, and I appreciate getting the insight to all that. That is so beautiful, always having you here every month to
thank you.
Discuss the history and let us know. And why don't you, if you can, give them again about the newspaper and where they
Certainly.
Can read that and what they can do?
Certainly. I write articles for the Greenville Pioneer, and this particular article on the evolution of the Christmas Carol is my 229th article for the paper. I've been writing nonstop since its first edition in May 2010, and this edition is available in Caro, Durham, Greenville, Westerlo, and Rensselaerville, in all the major stores, you know, like Stewart's and that sort of thing, and certainly through subscription through GreenvillePioneer.com.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sylvia.
And wishing everybody out there a very happy and Merry Christmas. And at the end of my article this year, I actually put it in as many languages that I thought made
really?
Sense. Oh, yes. I've got Joyeux Noël, Fröhliche Weihnachten, Happy Holidays, Merry Christmas. I can't pronounce it in Dutch. Buon Natale. I have it even in Irish. I have it in Polish. Feliz Navidad. I have it in Russian, and I wish everybody a joyful and prosperous new year as well.
Thank you.